Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I think one of the worst experiences that any one of us can have is looking back on something that's happened to us and realize that we were played, that we were suckered in, that we were but a pawn in somebody's larger game. I can think of a good example just off the top of my head. I'm sure this has happened to you. You walk into a store and you encounter a salesperson who is able to tap into the very essence of what it is that you want, even though you weren't planning on buying, let's say, a fairly large-scale purchase. This happened to me one time in Seattle years and years and years ago. I wandered into a waterbed store, and what happened was I had slept in a waterbed a couple times, and I thought, you know what, it'd be really great to have a waterbed, but they're very expensive. And this salesperson, though, I just was going in there to have a look around. This guy was an absolute genius salesperson. He was able to tap into that. The next thing I know, about an hour into the thing, I'm signing paperwork for paying on an installment plan. I'm buying a nearly $1,000 waterbed. And I walked out of the store going, what the hell just happened? I was played, but this guy was absolutely a genius salesperson. I got to give him props. And I paid this thing off, and we had that waterbed for probably about 7 or 8 years, even though we had to move it several times and it was super heavy. But the fact is, we don't like to feel like we were played, like we were suckered. But unfortunately, the fact is that it happens all the time, and especially when it comes to religion. This is also true when it comes to cults or other groups with undue influence. And that is the focus of this little bonus episode that I put together called The Psychology of the Pawn. And maybe you'll relate as we take a deeper dive into what does it mean to be a pawn in a larger game. How exactly does that affect us psychologically in terms of our identity and in other ways when we start to realize that we were played, that we were just a pawn? And it's kind of ironic because just the other day this song came up on my playlist, released in 1978 by Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. It's called Feel Like a Number, and maybe you can relate. Chorus goes on to say, I feel like a number. I feel like a number, like a stranger in this land. I feel like a number. Everything has been reduced down to you being a statistic on a sheet, as he says. And this is the thing, is that we don't want to admit that we're a pawn. We're a pawn in someone else's bigger game. And I've been realizing this, the more study, the more research I've been doing into this area of Christian dominionism, Christian reconstructionism, my own background growing up in a Church of Christ, I can give you at least three examples of where I have realized that I was but a pawn. And that's why I'm calling this bonus episode The Psychology of the Pawn. This is something that I've been realizing, and this is something that's proven to be quite helpful to me in terms of my own recovery of my own identity, or I should say, actually, the reconstruction, the discovery of who I am. I've been doing a lot of research on this topic of first and second generation religion or cult members. Those of us that were born into it, the fact is that we didn't have a pre-religious or pre-cult identity. We just accepted it all as true from day one. Now, there's even a bigger picture than that, and I'll give you three examples of how it's worked in my life, and maybe you can resonate to this. The first example is that I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian home just outside of Seattle, Washington, in the United States. My parents went to a Church of Christ, and they got involved in the Bill Gothard, at the time it was called the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts. Today it's called the Institute in Basic Life Principles, or IBLP, even though Bill Gothard himself has been formally sacked, you could say, for loads of allegations of sexual misconduct, sexual assault of young women in his organization. But of course, even though he's been removed formally as the director of the IBLP, his name is all over their website, all over their organization. If you look it up online, you'll find that his teachings are still very much part and parcel of what the IBLP is still about today. But anyway, my parents raised us according to Bill Gothard's teachings, and we've done podcasts on this. Me and my sister Valerie have done a couple episodes on this last couple of years where we talked about what it was like to grow up in a fundamentalist home, raised by the teachings of Bill Gothard, which in itself is ironic because he himself was never married, he never had children, and yet here he was giving these week-long seminars that were hugely popular, especially in the 70s, 80s, and on into the 90s, massively popular. Tens, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people all over America attended his seminars. And anyway, he was never married, though. He was always single. He never had a family. And yet here he was dispensing, quote, biblical advice on godly parenting, how to raise good children, and how to have a wonderful, God-honoring marriage, even though he never had children of his own or was married. And the strange part about it is nobody ever seemed to question that reality. How does a guy who's never been married, who's never had children, how does he know what a godly marriage looks like, how to raise good Christian children? How does this guy know? He's had no experience. But you know what? It didn't matter because he set himself up as an expert. He could interpret the Bible correctly, and on that basis, it didn't matter that he was single. He could give you God's word and correctly apply biblical teachings on how to raise your children correctly, how to have a godly marriage, and all the rest of it, and everybody just lapped it up. And I think one of the reasons why he was so popular was because at the time, coming out of the counterculture generation of the 60s and 70s, parents were desperate to get some answers on how to raise their children so they wouldn't go crazy like the hippie generation did. He was providing what seemed like sound biblical principles for how to have a good, solid marriage and how to raise good, godly children. And so his message resonated with an entire generation of really desperate Christian parents who were looking for answers, and boy, did he ever provide them. So here we are. My parents are raising us according to Bill Gothard's teachings. They are trying to institute his principles. And of course, this was hugely destructive, hugely damaging. And why was it so damaging? Particularly in my family, one of Bill Gothard's major principles was that you were underneath a bigger authority. So the children were under the authority of the mother. The mother was under the authority of the husband, the father. And I'll just say right here that I know it was hugely damaging to my parents' relationship because prior to them getting involved in the Gothard seminar, my parents' role had been my mom was much more the stronger person, the stronger personality. She kind of wore the pants in the family. My dad was much more passive. But Gothard taught that the wife had to be submissive to the authority of the husband. And my mom always chafed under that because my dad never really stepped up to the plate and took on the mantle of being that spiritual leader. And the way that Gothard justified this teaching was he used the metaphor of a series of umbrellas. If you've seen the diagram on his organization's website, it's a bunch of umbrellas, each of which over the top is bigger than the one underneath it. So you've got children, mother, father. The authority over the father is the state, you know, government, things like that. And then over the top of that is Christ and God. So the idea was that you're under the authority of somebody over you. You must submit to that godly authority in this sort of sphere sovereignty idea. And if you step outside of the protection of the umbrella that's above you, what's happening is that you are rebelling against God's divinely appointed authority. And in Gothard's teaching, this is just as serious as the sin of witchcraft, because he would say rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. It's a verse, I think, from Proverbs, and that was his famous quote about this. And he would say that once you step out from underneath the umbrella that is above you, you are opening yourself up to the attacks of Satan. You are no longer able to be protected by that umbrella over you when you step out from underneath this higher umbrella. And this is the teaching that I remember my mom talking about this when my sister Valerie got pregnant when she was about 17. And I remember she sat me down and she had this long conversation with me about how Valerie had stepped out from underneath the umbrella of her parents. And that is what opened her up to the attacks of the devil, and the fact that she had gotten pregnant. These were the consequences of her actions, and therefore there was really nothing they could do to help her now, because she was out in Satan's realm, as it were, and unprotected. So unfortunately for Valerie, she kind of had to go it alone. My parents really didn't do much to help her. They put her in a foster home, and there's a long story on that. If you want to look up that episode, it's on Podbean or on my website, mindshiftpodcast.co.uk. All those older episodes are archived. It's quite a moving story as she tells about her experiences being put into a foster home and being forced to give up her baby for adoption. And it's a very heartrending story. This was what happened to Valerie. I can't even imagine as a parent myself saying those kind of things, doing that to my own daughter. But that's what my parents did. They were following the teachings of Bill Gothard. And of course, all of us, her siblings, had to watch this whole thing go down. And we didn't know what to think because we were forced to choose sides between our parents and our sister Valerie. But one thing I do remember, it was hugely traumatic, certainly for us, her siblings, but obviously all the more so for Valerie, who was forced to go through this stuff pretty much on her own. Now, you put that context, okay, yes, that was one family in Seattle, Washington, going through the troubles and tribulations, trying to apply Gothard's teachings. We're still dealing with that today. But let's zoom out a little bit, because as damaging as Bill Gothard's teachings have been to so many people, he himself was but part of a larger movement, that of Christian Reconstructionism. Because as we know, now I've done this research, Gothard himself was part of this larger picture of a movement called Christian Reconstructionism, largely associated with a certain R.J. Rush Dooney. I've done episodes on this too. I've got one coming up with Julie Ingersoll in a few weeks where we talk about specifically Christian Reconstructionism, and we take a deep dive into Rush Dooney and what he taught. But one of the big things about what Rush Dooney taught, we're going back to the 50s and 60s and 70s when he was doing all of his writing and speaking. Rush Dooney was a proponent of Christian Reconstructionism, and Gothard picks up some of his teachings, even though he doesn't really admit that he does. However, if you know the language, you can start to pick up the teachings of someone like Rush Dooney in Bill Gothard. One of Rush Dooney's major points was this issue of godly authority, or what he calls sphere sovereignty. This is the idea that the lordship of God extends to every aspect, every area of life and society, that everyone's operating within a certain sphere or sector of their own particular authority, and this is all ordained by God. There are higher authorities above you, which are also set in place by God. And of course, we can see this right away in Gothard's umbrella of authority metaphor. And another aspect of Christian Reconstructionism is the teaching that the laws of the Bible, specifically the Old Testament, should be applied to every aspect of life. This is a little bit harder to trace in Gothard's teachings, but it carries with it the idea that the Bible is the supreme authority. And there are examples, I've read articles on his website, where Gothard will talk about people who submitted themselves to the law of God, even if it's from the Old Testament, and then God blessed them. And so for a guy like Rush Dooney, it was the application of the biblical law. This was the means by which, in Rush Dooney's view anyway, that humanity would be able to regain the dominion that Adam and Eve lost in the garden. And one of the big things that Rush Dooney was a proponent of, and in fact, you could say he was kind of the godfather of Christian education, and specifically Christian homeschooling. Yes, originally he was traveling all over the country in the 60s and 70s and 80s, speaking in churches, speaking in conferences, urging pastors to start Christian schools, but he really became a proponent of the Christian homeschooling movement. And one of the things that Rush Dooney did, he fought a lot of legal battles in courts to get the rights of parents to homeschool their kids. I should say Christian parents homeschooling their children, even though they may not have the educational background. It's thanks to guys like Rush Dooney who fought and won court cases in multiple states to prove that Christian parents should have the right to homeschool their children. Now, how does Bill Gothard factor into this? Well, one of the arms of the Institute and Basic Life Principles is an organization called ATI, Advanced Training Institute, and this is a Christian homeschooling arm of Gothard's IBLP. And so what ATI does is they supply curriculum both to Christian schools and to Christian homeschoolers. So you can buy curriculum from ATI, and this is part of what Gothard has been doing for a long time. So he's part of this Christian Reconstructionist movement. The idea then is to craft children in the home and in these Christian schools and raise them up with these godly principles, in air quotes, and send them out into the world. And it's going to be a generational thing, but eventually there's going to be enough of them where they'll permeate all of society and start to affect it and change it for the better and ultimately bring about the kingdom of God. And so I was part of this, just a pawn, as Bob Seger would say, a tiny blade of grass in a great big field. I wasn't aware of any of these things at the time. Of course, I didn't know anything. I'd never heard of the name Rush Dooney. I'd never heard of Christian Reconstructionism. And yet, even though I didn't go to an ATI school, I was still influenced by the teachings of Gothard, who in turn was influenced by guys like Rush Dooney and other Christian Reconstructionists. So there again, there's an example, number one, of what I was talking about, that you're a pawn in this larger game, this larger story, and you don't know that you're being manipulated and controlled. You think you have free choices and free will, but you find out later, no, I was being raised and taught, indoctrinated really from day one. I never had a choice because that was the truth as I saw it. And I trusted my parents. I trusted my pastor. They recommended that we go to the Bill Gothard seminar, and we did. I can remember going to the ones in Seattle, sitting there all week, filling in the workbook, taking really careful notes. I really wanted to understand it and get it right and tried to institute those things into my life. So I was a pawn. I was a tiny blade of grass. So that's my first example. Second example kind of correlates to what we're talking about. Here I was raised in the Church of Christ. Part of that, of course, as I was saying, is that they recommended that we go to the Gothard Seminar. A lot of the families in our church ended up going to the Gothard Seminar. But one of the other things about the Church of Christ that I was raised in was that they taught a theology called baptismal regeneration. In other words, their theology was, when you'd ask somebody in the Church of Christ, my Church of Christ, you'd say, how do I become a Christian? The answer was, you get baptized. In other words, to become a Christian means getting baptized. So here I was, a kid of 10 or so years old. I'm seeing my friends getting baptized. I'd seen that movie, A Thief in the Night. They played that at one of the evening services, and I was terrified that I was going to miss the rapture and I would end up going through the tribulation and being martyred, and then I'd end up in hell. You know, so here I was absolutely terrified. I went to the pastor and I asked him, I want to become a Christian. How do I do that? And he said, let's get you baptized. So I did. At the age of 10, I got baptized in this Church of Christ. But of course, nothing happened other than me getting dunked in a tank of water for the next 3 years. Here I was trying to live the Christian life sort of under my own steam, as it were, and failing miserably. Well, I went to the pastor when I was 13. We had another pastor by that time. And I asked him, I said, look, man, I'm having a real hard time. What do I need to do? I need some help here. Can you help me out? And so we went through the whole story, and he put his finger on the problem, and he said, you know what, your problem is that first baptism when you were 10, you didn't understand what was going on. Maybe there was something wrong. It really didn't take. What we need to do is get you re-baptized. We need to do it again. We need to do it the right way this time, and that'll solve your problem. And so we did. I came in on a Saturday. There was nobody in the church except for this lady who was cleaning the church, and she saw what was going on. She came in, sat down in the front row, and watched me get baptized by the pastor at the age of 13 for the second time. And he did all the right things. He said all the right formulas, as it were, the Trinitarian formula. I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He baptized me, and that was it. I thought, my problems are over. Well, of course, my problems were not over, and I was not a Christian. I didn't know what that means. Again, all I'd done is gotten dunked in the tank for the second time. You know, so this led to a lot of problems as I was trying to work these things out. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. One of the key teachings in the Church of Christ, or certainly at least the Church of Christ that I attended, was they taught this thing called Lordship Salvation. And I remember hearing this when I was a kid, going to Christian summer camps, and we'd hear these preachers, and we'd have these mountaintop experiences. And I can remember my own pastor asking us the same question. And the question was, is Jesus both the Savior and the Lord of your life? In other words, yes, you look to him for salvation, but the famous question was, is he sitting on the throne of your heart? And I can remember asking myself as a kid, what in the world does that mean? Jesus sitting on the throne of my heart. I didn't know what that meant. And they would say, it's not enough for you just to get saved. You've got to actually surrender every aspect of your life to the lordship of Jesus Christ. He's got to be sitting on the throne of your heart, as it were, in a metaphorical way. You've got to step down off your throne and let Jesus climb up there and be the Lord of your life. Well, I tried this as a kid. I didn't know what that meant. But here I was already racked with trauma from the fact that I'd been baptized not once, but twice. I was failing as a Christian. Every time I'd fall into some kind of sin, like pornography or whatever, I'd beg God for help, but nothing was ever forthcoming. And none of that seemed to make any sense to me. Wasn't God interested in helping me to become that better Christian? I'd asked him to be the Lord of my heart. He was sitting on the throne. But when it came right down to it, my behavior hadn't changed in the slightest. And now there's some preacher up there asking me, is Jesus the Lord of your life? What does that even mean? And I'm going around thinking to myself, what in the hell am I supposed to be doing? I'm failing. I'm having all kinds of problems here. It's not working. And ended up struggling with that for most of my adult life. And then when I was a youth pastor in my mid-20s down in Oregon, down in Portland area, I was actually going to Bible college. I ended up getting baptized for a third and final time by our pastor. I felt really bad because here I was the youth pastor. I was going to Bible college. I'm leading these youth groups. I'm leading these kids. I'm teaching them from the Bible and everything else. And yet, I was pretty sure I needed to get baptized now that I really knew for sure what it all meant. So I went to the pastor and I kind of unburdened myself and I confessed that, yeah, I'd been baptized twice before, but neither one of those had taken. Now I considered myself a definite Christian, but I needed to set an example here and I really needed to get this thing done. So we made the decision. We knew there was a youth group camp out coming up at a campground out in the forest. So the pastor baptized me in the river and that was my third and final baptism. And hopefully it stuck that last time. But now, let's put a bigger picture on this whole thing. When I was in seminary a few years later, I was doing an MA degree and I was taking a class on church history. And the professor started talking about a particular brand of theology. And as he went down the list and was describing this particular theological movement, I thought to myself, my God, that's exactly the theology that I was raised in. And I said, what is this theology? And he said, it's called Keswick theology. And I said, what in the world is Keswick theology? I'd never heard of that term. I didn't know what it was. I had no idea. And he began to explain. He said, well, in Victorian England, back in about 1850-something, there's a little town up in the Lake District called Keswick. And I've since been there. It's a beautiful little town. If you ever get a chance to visit, you definitely need to go to the Lake District. But here's this little town in the Lake District, north of England, called Keswick. And it was part of this movement called the Holiness Movement or the Higher Life Movement, started in the Victorian era. And they would have these retreats, these week-long or several week-long events in this little town of Keswick, and hundreds, if not thousands of people would come in, and they taught this idea that not only did you need to get saved, but then later your sanctification would be like an instantaneous breakthrough, that you'd have this boom moment where you would make Jesus the Lord of your life. And this is some of the ideas of where this concept of putting Jesus on the throne of your heart comes from, this instant sanctification. And as he went down the list, I'm going, my God, this is exactly the stuff I was raised to believe was true. I'd never heard of it. I never knew anything about it until I was sitting in this seminary class and I started putting the pieces together. And so as I've seen now, what happened was as this movement came back across to America, it infiltrated and influenced a lot of churches, and some of the churches of Christ picked up this Keswick theology, or at least aspects of it. So here's my little church in Seattle, Washington, and I'm going there as a kid, never knowing the word Keswick, never heard of this holiness movement, this higher life movement, never heard of any of this stuff, and yet I was being influenced by something that happened 100, 150 years before in another country that I was utterly, completely unaware of. So there we have it. Once again, a tiny blade of grass in a great big field. I'm just a pawn. I'm just a number. I'm something that's being manipulated by forces larger than me, outside of my control. Never had a clue. Didn't know anything about it until I started researching it and studying it. There again, another example of how you're influenced and moved by forces that you are completely, utterly unaware of. All right, let's move on to the third example I'm going to lay on you. I mentioned a minute ago that I went to Bible college down in Portland. I went down there. My wife and I moved down there in 1993. I did the whole 4 years at this Bible college in Portland, graduated with a bachelor's degree, then went on to seminary. Now, one of the things I learned, it was a good education in the sense that it opened me up to other theological traditions. Here I was coming out of the Church of Christ. I'd been shown this fairly narrow sort of interpretation. We didn't believe in the gifts of the Spirit. We didn't believe in speaking in tongues. We didn't believe in miracles. We were what was called a cessationist church. You know, so we had these certain theological traditions. We had this Keswick theology, of which I was completely unaware, but I had been raised in this tradition thinking that it was all true. And so, of course, when you go to a school like this, you get exposed as you study church history and other theological traditions to other movements. And I became aware of the fact that I was just one small pawn in this bigger game. I was being moved and manipulated by forces that were much larger than me, just like my example of Keswick theology. But one of the things I learned at this Bible college was that it itself was part of a bigger movement. Let me explain. So this Bible college that I attended in Portland was founded in the mid-1930s, and it was specifically intended to be started on the West Coast, because at the time there were very few institutions like that, a quote school of the Bible that was really emphasizing the study of the Bible as one of its core sort of planks in the platform. And what's interesting to point out is that the founders, or most of them anyway, were all professors at Dallas Theological Seminary. And they had a specific aim, as I say, to start a Bible college on the West Coast to kind of extend their reach further westward. And so the aim from the beginning was to establish a conservative presence on the West Coast. Now, let's go back and trace the history. What about Dallas Seminary? Well, I come to find out that Dallas Seminary itself was part of a larger movement. It was originally founded in 1924, and that itself tells us a lot because it's in the middle of a historical religious context, coming out of the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, where liberal theology was creeping into the church. And what happened as a result of that was there was a corresponding counter-reaction, which was the fundamentalist movement, right around, as I say, end of the 19th century and on up to about 1940s, 1950s, the fundamentalist movement really kind of gained traction, and they were reacting against what they saw as liberal attacks against the Bible and against what they considered orthodox Christian theology. So you had these fundamentalists who were in schools like Princeton and Yale. They were part of what used to be, they used to be seminary training schools. Well, there was kind of this mass exodus by these fundamentalists, and they went out, and their aim was to start their own Bible colleges, and they would be fundamentalist bastions of orthodoxy, and they would really take a stand against this encroaching liberalism that was infecting the church like a virus. And a lot of this feeds into what they call winning the culture war. As they saw it, it was a war for the hearts and minds and souls of not just Americans, but people all over the world, because they were big on missions as well. And so we can point to this kind of movement within the religious culture, and that's what gives rise to a school like Dallas Seminary. So then you fast forward 10 or 15 years, you've got a group of these professors at Dallas Seminary, and they're having these discussions saying, we don't have any presence on the West Coast, we need to get out there and start this other Bible college, and that's exactly what they did. So once again, here's an example of the psychology of the pawn. I'm finding myself decades later at this Bible college in Portland, Portland, I'm part of a tradition coming out of a place like Dallas Seminary, which is itself coming out of a larger reactionary movement, fundamentalism, reacting to liberal theology. So once again, I'm in this movement, I'm caught up in this thing of which I'm completely unaware. Now, how do these three examples relate to this issue of the psychology of the pawn? Well, I hope that's been clear now that what I've been describing in my own life, these three examples at least, are examples of when I was but a pawn in a much larger game, a much larger movement. And later, now that I can look back on it, I can see how I was controlled and manipulated. I thought I was making informed choices, but the fact was I was not. And I didn't know about all these other bigger forces at play. Now let's take a look at the actual psychology of the pawn in terms of the cult or the religious experience. What resonates to me is when I read Robert J. Lifton's Eight Markers of Cults, he talks about things like what he calls mystical manipulation or planned spontaneity. This is what he refers to as the psychology of the pawn. And in his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, Lifton goes through actually eight markers of cults or religions, controlling religions with undue influence. And he's talking about the psychology of the pawn as it relates to milieu control. In other words, the control of the communication, the control of the actual environment in which the member within a cult or a religion finds him or herself. And when you go on into the second step, this is when Lifton gets into this concept of mystical manipulation or planned spontaneity, the psychology of the pawn. And he describes it as follows. He says, quote, "The process is managed so that it appears to arise spontaneously. To its object, it rarely feels like manipulation. Religious techniques such as fasting, chanting, and limited sleep are used," end quote. And that's actually a quote from his article, Cult Formation, which is taken from his book. And what I describe this as, it's part of the overall milieu control. In other words, in my view, the recruit, the cult recruit, or in evangelical terms, we'd say the seeker, someone who's seeking spiritual guidance. Okay, so we used to refer to non-Christians who were seeking God. We call them seekers. When they come into that church service, when that recruit enters the Scientology Center or is encountering that first service of the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons or whatever religion or cult you're walking into, you merely think you're having an organic experience. However, it's carefully contrived. It's planned in advance, if not completely rehearsed and staged. So in other words, when you're in the evangelical terms, you have a profound experience of God. You're in a worship service. But you know what? It is a legitimate emotional experience. It absolutely is. You are being moved. You are being swept up in this emotional experience. And they're describing it as you are experiencing God. This is what's happening. It's legitimate. It's a real experience. However, you're being played. You're a pawn. It's better seen, I think, as your reaction to a staged and crafted emotional scene. So in other words, the singing, the lighting, the speaking in tongues, the ecstatic worship, whatever, the feelings of joy, being swept up in that, it's all part of the mystical manipulation. You are being controlled as a pawn in someone else's larger game. This is something that Chris Shelton and I talked about in a recent podcast. He said that when you walk into a Scientology center, how do people get involved? Well, this is how they get recruited in. They think that they're just having an organic conversation with one of the Scientology people staffing this center. And they get drawn in, they have a personality test, they might do some things to get them pulled in, and the next thing you know, they're actually getting involved in Scientology, they're getting pulled in. But what Chris pointed out was, he said, everything was staged, everything was sort of planned, it was all rehearsed well ahead of time. Every time a new recruit walks in the door, they think they're having an actual organic experience, but they're being pulled in. And my response to it was, well, we kind of did the same thing when I was an evangelical. We do evangelism training. We used to do role playing. We'd sit down across from somebody else and say, okay, if I say this to you as a non-Christian, if I pose this particular question, how do you respond to it? What do you say? We need to train these people up. And I remember going to a seminar in my church in Seattle years ago. We went to see Hank Hanegraaff, who is, of course, the Bible Answer Man on the radio. He did an evangelism training seminar, and he gave us all these sort of memory tricks and tips to recall things when we're faced with different scenarios, talking to non-believers, Bible verses that we could quickly recall and quote back to them, answers to common questions, common objections to Christianity, the problem of evil and all the rest of it. We had an answer, you know, and that's how we did it. And I can recall walking out of seminars like that. And in fact, I used to teach them as well, missional lifestyle evangelism and all that. I felt a lot more confidence. And again, when I would talk to people, these things would come to mind, these answers, and I was able to bat down objections that people had to the faith, and I felt pretty secure in my faith because I, as a Christian, was supposed to be evangelizing the world, and that's what I was doing, and I'd been trained. And again, the person I was interacting with thought that it was an organic conversation, but it was staged, it was crafted, it was all rehearsed well ahead of time. Now, I don't know what your experiences are. Maybe you've resonated with some of the examples that I've laid out in this little bonus episode. What I'm hoping it'll do for you is that I hope that it'll help you to unpick the conditioning. This is something that I learned from ex-Scientologist John Atack. And what he says is you've got to educate yourself. You've got to unpick the conditioning. In other words, you need to go back and find out in terms of your own reconstruction, your rebuilding of your own identity, how were you manipulated? How were you controlled? And hopefully some of my examples will help you to think through, okay, what was I doing? Where was I a pawn? Where was I being controlled and manipulated in this larger picture? And hopefully some of the resources that I've given you in this episode can help you to kind of identify some of the larger forces that were at play, whether you came out of a cult or a controlling sort of fundamentalist Bible religion like I did. We were control. We were but pawns in a much larger game. And I hope that helps you to kind of think some of these things through, or at least gives you the tools by which to analyze your own past experiences. Once you start to figure out how you were controlled, how you were manipulated, it disempowers a lot of that, I believe. I've come to see that in my own life. It helps you to kind of disavow that. And when you meet up with other people who have had similar experiences to yours, not only does it give you the language to be able to identify your own experiences and say, okay, yeah, that's what happened to me. Now I can describe how I was controlled, manipulated, where I was a pawn in this game. But also, it's hugely empowering because you go, okay, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone in this thing. There's a lot of other people who had similar experiences to mine. I'm not alone. And this is something that is hugely helpful. And then another part of that is going out and finding a new supportive community. Maybe you have to form a new tribe. And once you disengage with your past sort of cult or religious experience, one of the biggest questions that people have is, what do I do now? Where do I go from here? Because you've lost everything you loved, you knew, you thought you knew. Now it's all being questioned. It's all being deconstructed. The whole house of cards has perhaps come crashing down. What do? You've lost your support network. You may have lost friends, certainly family who are still in the cult or the religion. Where do you go from here? Well, now it may be time to form a new tribe. And this is something that I'm working hard to do. One of the things that we have as part of being a supporter of this show on Patreon is you get access to our closed Facebook group. And there's nearly 80 some people in there now. I'm not sure. We're a little bit under 100 people, but it's a very good supportive community. And we prop each other up basically when we go through rough times, we have good discussions in there. That's one way to form a new tribe. That's one way to be a part of a new community. And there's all sorts of support groups online as well as on Twitter. You can find things, hashtag exvangelical, hashtag excult. Look up some of these things, XJW, ex-Mormon, whatever it might be, wherever you come from, you can find groups, you can find communities in places like Reddit and other places where you can get some support and the help that you need. Certainly Facebook has got a lot lot of groups, a lot of support groups as well. So if you have any thoughts, comments, questions on this bonus episode, drop me a DM. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also look up the MindShift Podcast Facebook page or drop into my website, mindshiftpodcast.co.uk, and look up some articles there. I've got some more resources as well as ways to get a hold of me. So I hope you enjoyed this little bonus episode on the psychology of the pawn. Let me know what your thoughts, comments, questions are, and I'll see you again. We'll do another bonus episode on something. I'm not sure what we're going to do, but I always love doing these ones. So thanks for dropping in on this bonus episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Thanks for coming along with me as we delve into the psychology of the pawns.